Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky.
Hello, welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm your host, Darren Bresnitz. We are heading back to Brooklyn today to chat with Max and Marco, the new co-executive chefs at the Chef's Table at Brooklyn Fair. They have taken over the legendary tasting menu and taking it to new heights. It is a fantastic chat about how they met cooking together on the line in Europe, what brought them to New York, and what it means to take over such an incredible and highly vaulted spot. Then it's a deep dive into the archive, and we are swinging by Tulum to stop at Gitano, the famous club, and chatting with the house band Habe. They give us a live musical performance and talk to us about being an international music collective with Middle Eastern rhythms and a sound that is live looping with electronic music, one of a kind, and such a blast for us to share with you. So please sit back, relax, and enjoy Snacky Tunes here on HRN.
Thank you.
Max and Marco, welcome to Snacky Tunes. Congratulations on the return, and it's great to have you on the show.
Thank you so much.
We are very happy to be here.
You know, it's so rare these days to have chefs leave a restaurant and then come back. A lot of times, if you're in this fine dining world or upper echelon of cuisine, it's like you get moved to open up the empire. Like you're the first outpost. So what does it feel to come back as executive chefs as Brooklyn Fare?
It feels absolutely amazing. Like we have the best opportunity there is in the nicest city and in one of the best restaurants of the world. So we are very, you know, happy, and it's a dream coming true.
All right, let's go back a little bit. So both born in Europe, Max, you're in Austria, Marco in Holland, and I know that the moms and the grandmas of your family were big chefs, and you talked about their influence. What do you remember about their cooking? What stayed with you? How early did you get into the kitchen with them?
So we got into the kitchen with them. I got in the kitchen with them already in an early stage. My mom was always super busy working, but on Saturday and Sunday, she was always like very into cooking, nurturing family, and just celebrating the whole together. And that was always like, I was always torn to that, and always felt like a magnetic vibe in the kitchen, and everybody was meeting in the kitchen, and you can taste and can see and smell, and all those inputs were amazing.
Yeah, for my part, I grew up as a farmer family boy. So my mom and dad, they're both working, they had their own company, a big farm. And honestly, it's like also in a region where all the best vegetables, flowers, very famous region in the Netherlands, you know, very modern techniques they use. So I grew up and we always had seasonable products, you know, and that's like we had our own chicken. So, you know, you have your own eggs, you harvest your own strawberries, blueberries in the summer. In the winter, you had citrus fruits, apples, pears. So, and I still remember those flavors, and I fell really in love with products and cooking, and my mom made amazing food with that, as well as my grandma did. Yeah, so that's like the way how I was like, you know. It was very inspirational for me.
Well, no, it's interesting because the way that you talk about it, like, let's be honest, when most Americans travel to Europe and they think of food, they're probably not thinking of Austria and Holland. But no. But the way you two describe it, it's, you know, why not think of those two areas? So what do people not understand? What do outsiders not get about the culinary cuisine of both your backgrounds, the cities you grew up in?
I think like the Netherlands has a, of course, like they have like kind of an, they have a cuisine that's a little bit underrated sometimes, but they also have like, they have amazing products. Like we are all surrounded by a sea, the North Sea. And that is like, you know, it's such a gem. You know, we have one of the best oysters. We have, you know, amazing lobsters in season. We also work now here in the restaurant with a turbot. It's a flat fish. It's like the king of the sea, we call it there. It's very high end. And,
yeah,
you know, we import it. We serve it here on the menu, and people, they love it. It's absolutely amazing. And, you know, it's great.
And Max, what about you? What do people miss about where you grew up?
Actually, it's super parallel, Holland and Austria. The cuisine is there. The DNA is there from the all historic, from the history. But at the end of the day, we are not lucky enough to be located near a sea. So people in a couple of years really try to focus more on the regional products, like amazing smoked sturgeon, trout, farm-raised, the diversity of tomatoes, for example, or onions. This is all happening in Austria right now. And we're also trying to honor our heritage here at the restaurant. We're trying to put our own DNA stamp on the dishes. So we also, as Marco said, using the turbo from Holland. We're using the smoked sturgeon from America, but it has obviously the roots from Austrian cuisine as well. So we're also trying to do that.
Yeah, I mean, you have these cuisines and these well-known produce, you were sort of born into the kitchen, and then you both cut your teeth in the fine dining scene across Europe. I mean, we don't have enough time to go through all the incredible restaurants you worked at. So I'd love to hear more about what was the culture like at the time? You have any stories to share? I mean, it's not too long ago because you guys are relatively young, but it is definitely, I think, like a different era than what is going on in kitchens today.
100%. Back in the day, it was more hard working in the kitchen. Much more people wanted to work in the kitchen. And so it trickled down from the head chef down. So the atmosphere and the vibe was much more competitive, I believe, than today. Especially changed after COVID. And back in the day, it was you had to work with much more elbow. You know what I'm saying? Not in a negative way, but you have to be much more focused and see the end goal, what you want to become. So I think that definitely has changed, as you already said.
Yeah. People, like we work already together for a long time. Since 2009, we worked in a very famous restaurant at that day. Sadly, it closed because the chef owner moved on to other, you know, opportunities and vendors. But like we worked there together since 2009, and that was a restaurant with 3 stars. It's called Outsluis, and people were honestly lined up there to work in the kitchen. Yeah. So when you got a spot there, it was amazing. And basically the first weeks you did like a tryout of stars. They really saw like, hey, does this guy has it in him or not? Is he hungry enough? Can he stand, you know? Can he work 18 hours a day? It was a different vibe. Yeah. So that is, I think nowadays that is really the difference.
Yeah. I mean, but also there's been a shift because, you know, tasting menus, fine dining has, it's not out of fashion. It's just, you know, when I look at restaurants, let's just say LA or New York, new spots opening, the people who are trying to open up these fine dining restaurants, people who are going for Michelin stars is not as common as it used to be. But you guys were part of so many spots that got Michelin stars and things like that. So, you know, it's still important, but some people think it's a shifting in priority. What do you guys feel like? Because you were part of teams that helped get there and sustain them, but now the dining landscape has changed a little bit.
The dining landscape has definitely changed, but I still think that the tasting menu, and we can see it here at the Chef's Table in New York because you have direct contact with the customers. It's a shift. It's much more younger crowd. People are really into it, especially with all the films coming out. So I wouldn't say that the fine dining is sort of dying out. I think it's quite rejuvenating, and you can absolutely see that a lot of people are into it, and a lot of young people are into it and really enjoying themselves coming there, especially for their birthday or for celebrating something special. Or it's, you can really tell that it's a much younger crowd than back in the day.
Oh, I mean, I did my 40th at a Michelin star restaurant. That's exactly how I celebrated.
Exactly. Yeah.
But when I was younger, I mean, the prices have changed too.
Of course.
I used to be like, well, let's dial up a tasting menu a little bit more often than today. I also didn't have 2 kids in daycare, but that's another story.
Yeah.
So you guys mentioned you met back in 2009.
At the same section.
Was a partnership
side by side.
Like, did you guys get along? Because sometimes there's sharp elbows in those kitchens, you know?
No, we got along very well. Yeah, right away, off the bat.
Yeah.
It was more like teamwork. It was super tough kitchen to work in. Probably the toughest kitchen we will ever work in, because it was so time consuming. Yeah. And people nowadays think it's all a joke when we tell those stories, but it was all... That's all what happened. And but this tough environment, I think, creates a brotherhood and a core where you always think back to. And now I get goosebumps just thinking back to working one section. So it really melted us together going through these hard times. And now it's just like a natural bond we have, I would say.
Yes, I can totally agree on that. And it's like, as you say, it was very hard. But if I have to do it all over again, I will do it in a heartbeat, because it was one of the most amazing experiences.
Yeah.
And you really create bonds there that are for life. Even if you work with people there and you don't see them for 10 years, you see them again, it's like the day of yesterday. It's like so special. It's like you go into war.
Yeah. I mean, I've heard that analogy before, and it's, you know, the biggest thing that I've seen in the industry, and I've heard from other chefs, is that, you know, people don't stay at places that long to even develop those bonds anymore. You know, some people,
they just 6 months, around.
A year, they're like, I got what I need. And you know, it's going deep versus going wide, which is shifted as well. So you're doing well in Europe. You guys are both from there. New York calls. When does New York start calling? Do you guys go at the same time? Why? I mean, I feel like you guys could have gone and opened up another spot, been another part of another team in Europe. So why go to the city?
So from my point of view, it was that we both worked in Holland. There was a guy coming from New York, from 11 Madison Park, who was back in the day, huge deal. And he was making a stage with us. His name is Austin. He is now a one Michelin star restaurant here in Tribeca. And then he said, well, there is a spot open at the Nomad Hotel. We're just opening that, which was like the sister restaurant with Daniel Hume. It's a one Michelin star restaurant. And I saw that back in the day as an opportunity just to check out New York City. And it hit off right off the bat. And yeah, that's where I started my culinary career in New York abroad.
Yeah, I mean, you also showed up at a time, and I want to get to that right after the break, because when you showed up to New York, the restaurant scene was one of the best in the world, and just it was wild.
Yeah.
All right, let's take a quick break. I want to talk about coming to the city, the different cultural changes, and then your first stint at Chef's Table Brooklyn Fare together. We have a song from the archives here on Snacky Tunes on HRN. Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We are with Max and Marco, the executive chefs at Chef's Table at Brooklyn Fare. And before the break, we're talking about you winding up in New York in the late aughts, which was arguably one of the most exciting times in this city to be a diner. I was cutting my teeth in restaurants, and I just felt like it was an endless opening, and there was exciting ideas everywhere. And I even got to eat at the original Brooklyn Fair, which makes me think that I was at the table when you guys were
probably
cooking.
Yes.
How did you wind up at Brooklyn Fair the first time, and what was different about, because this, you know, look, you're still doing like Michelin star tasting menus, but you're in America now. What was the difference? How did you feel? How did you wind up at Brooklyn Fair?
I started my job here in New York City at 11 Madison Park. But for me, it was a big, big change. And they have, for me, the best organization, so structural and like almost like military style. It's like, you know, big hats off to that organization, very super nice restaurant. But for me, it was a little bit too big, you know. I was more familiar with a smaller team. It was, you know, so I needed another, you know, another tryout somewhere else. And what I did then, I heard already of the chef's table. And honestly, it's a very funny story because Max and me, when we were still in the Netherlands, we were talking about Michelin star restaurants. And the Michelin guide came out in New York. And then the chef's table, they received the 3 Michelin stars. And they received it in even like 2 years because they got the first 2 stars in the first year and they got 3 stars right after that. So it was like such a special place.
Yeah.
So it was already big time on the radar. And then I just, what I did on my day off, I was like, okay, because I had a J1 student visa. So honestly, I said to myself, you know, they were sponsoring me. I wanted to stay here, but I just wanted to work somewhere else because I cannot do this anymore at 11 Madison Park because, you know, I didn't like it that much. And I know I went on my day off. I went to Brooklyn. I just stepped into the restaurant. The chef, Cesar, was sitting there. And I asked him, like, hey, do you have a spot free? I'm looking for a spot in the kitchen. And right off the bat, he said, no, I don't have a spot free. And I was like, okay. And then he asked me, like, okay, but where are you from? I said, I'm from the Netherlands. And I worked at the restaurant Altsluis. And then he was like, hey, wait a second. You know, I know that place. He said, you have a minute to chat. So then I had a small talk with him. I went back the other week, did a tryout, got a job, and I was, you know, that was how I started at the in the old location in Brooklyn, Skermerhorn Street, and it was really, you know, one of the most amazing times. We had a very small team at that time, but it was like, yeah, I loved it from the first day.
I mean, it was a special place, and tasting menus were definitely shifting in that time. To really incorporating molecular gastronomy. Obviously, like El Bulli is a huge influence on that. But yeah. What did you guys see, especially in America? Was there more freedom to experiment than maybe tasting menus in Europe? Did you have a little bit more room to play, or was it still sort of following these set rules?
So Marco actually brought me also on to the team at Chef's Table because there was an opportunity because we're such a small team, and so he just told me, no, it's the perfect time to come. And then I got hired right off the bat, and me and Marco I think had the feeling that Cesar was doing something nobody did at that time. Of course, it was the red string in the whole menu, which was this tasting menu. But back in the day, we had like how many courses, Marco? How many small dishes?
22
small bites with amazing German porcelain from Herring Berlin, and the best products coming from Japan, from back in the day, Tsukiji Fish Market, and all small bites, a slither of Saba, a small Kasuku Dai. It was really, for me and Marco, I believe it was eye-opening to just see the perfection of product coming into the door alone, starting with how they wrap the fish and how they treat the fish. So it was really something highly special, but always compared and paired with French technique. That was something I've never been in touch before.
Yeah, and it's interesting because you you see versions or, you know, nods to that cuisine now.
Of course.
But when you're eating there in the first time, and we chatted with Hannah at Quarter Sheets, who was at Chez Panisse when she started, And you'd be like, oh, like I feel like I've seen this a million times. I was like, yes, but this is where it started. This is
exactly
like the core. And that's got to be so inspirational. You know, what was the reaction? Do you have any stories of guests coming in, or do you remember serving people and them having a similar response the way you guys did?
Yes, a lot of people. Some people understood it, especially the Asian clientele understood it, but there were a lot of European chefs coming in, guests who didn't understand back in the day the simplicity of just the product touched with, for example, binchudan with a pickled kelp leaf. And this standing on a pedestal of white German ceramic, they didn't get that back in the day. Now I have the feeling it's back to the shift of being more product focused, and now more and more people are doing that. But as you said before, this was like the nucleus of this combination of the Japanese-French cuisine. And a lot of people forget that we worked there for such a long time. So it is actually also our Marco and my DNA. So it was really something special back in the day.
And you have to understand that we were from Europe, and we have amazing product, but we don't have the Japanese. We don't have access to the Japanese fish market.
No, it doesn't exist. 20-hour flight. I mean,
It's no, but that, you know, I think New York, and then you have of course Tokyo, and then comes New York. But I think, you know, Anthony Bourdain said it one time. I mean, it was maybe a little bit overrated. He said sometimes, you know, New York have better sushi restaurants than Tokyo. Like, you know, and it's like, you know, there is, of course, I don't agree with that because I've been to Tokyo, but I need to say, like, you know, such an access, like we have it now too. We have our own guy in Tsuzuki Fish Market. That's, we are like constantly in touch with him, you know, like he's searching for us, like the best products that are seasonable, not seasonable. Like it's amazing. Like it's a luxury you have, and that, you know, and the European clientele, they didn't understand that, you know, but now they are like, now they are maybe kind of jealous that we have access to such an amazing product like sea urchin, like madai, like the best tuna. It's like, yeah, it's really a gem to have that.
So look, you're at this exciting spot. You have clientele, three Michelin star. Why leave? You know, why did you guys feel it was time to move on the first time?
So for me, it was time. I believe I stayed there for 3.5 years, and there was an opportunity coming up to take over a chef's table in the Austrian Alps with 18 seats, go back to Austria. Yeah. And this was my first head chef opportunity. And like Marco said before, if I would do it again, I would do it again, because I was well protected with not having any Michelin stars in Austria. And I could really get my own groove, my own DNA, my own dishes, work on much more regional products around this area in the Alps. And it was a huge, huge benefit I had without any city pressure of delivering every day. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, totally, totally.
And this was a very great opportunity for me to get to feel with 27 my first kitchen chef position. And that was, I stayed there for 5.5 years. So it's really an amazing opportunity.
Yeah.
And Marco, what dictated your first step away from chef's table?
I also, like, I stay almost like maybe also 5.5, 6 years. And then there was an opportunity coming up in the East Village, like a small restaurant spot, like also a counter restaurant, Ukio. Mm-hmm. And I came in touch with them. He also had another restaurant, Jua Bako. And he said, like, well, the restaurant is totally dead here, you know. He did, like, before had a different name, the place. Sure. He said, can you take this opportunity, you know, hire two other chefs and bring this back to life? And that, for me, was such a big opportunity. And it was totally the opposite, because, you know, at the chef's table here, we have everything. We have the nicest equipment. We have a beautiful stove. We have the best plate. We have the best product. And over there, you know, it's like you have a Rolls Royce and you're gonna, with all due respect, you're gonna drive in a Honda, for example. So, and that's what I did, and I learned a lot of that. I received a Michelin star, you know, in 2019, I received 1 star for that. Honestly, on the end, things didn't work out because, you know, it was just like we were on a different page, me and the owner. You know, I wanted to push harder, and he was like, he said a little bit, wanted more patience with that. It's maybe also, you know, I was so hungry and so you know, how do I say
motivated.
Motivated, you know, to reach for the sky. But as I say, I'm very proud of the job that we did there and that we received in that place in the East Village. You know, we received one star. That's really like winning the Super Bowl with the Detroit
it's
Lions.
Incredible.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
But I have to imagine, or maybe not, but so was chef's tables just in the back of your mind? I mean, you know, did you ever think that you would return, or and what was it like when you got the call? Because obviously, and we don't need to get into it, there is the situation around the restaurant and the past ex-chef who was a big mentor to you and taught you a lot. And then you get asked to replace him is a tough word the way you think about it, but yep. You're coming in to step in to this.
Yep.
How did you feel about it? You know, would you think about the restaurant? What was it like to get to come back, not just as someone working, but as co-executive chefs?
It's a crazy, unimaginable idea. We both never thought about that, to be honest. And I can easily talk about me and Marco because it was always, we always thought that this is going to be by itself running till the end of times because it was such a huge institution, you know? Right, Marco?
Yes, absolutely. I never thought, and it was a big, big, big surprise, but it was like, you know, it was like I had to punch myself and I told my wife like am I dreaming or is this really true because
it's
the biggest opportunity in life you can get.
Yes, absolutely.
But so you come back and you're leading the helm. Now you've both stepped away, you've both run your own restaurants, and as we mentioned, like this is post-pandemic, restaurant culture has changed. But you're still working at one of the biggest high-end tasting restaurants in the world and keeping up the stars that you've won. How did you balance, I guess, the new way that people are running restaurants and then also bringing along longtime customers, but saying like, we're going to do things maybe a little bit differently?
Exactly. So this is the balance act we are having right now. But we also have to say that we have the amazing luck to have an owner who is fully committed and standing behind us and really understands the restaurant, the ethos of the restaurant. And again, this restaurant is all about the best product and you have to respect the past. We respect the past, but it's a fine line of respecting the past and also trying to put our own DNA on dishes. And this is what we are doing now by slowly incorporating the turbo from Holland, slowly incorporating the smoked sturgeon here and there, still having, because this restaurant was successful for 12 to 13 years with 3 Michelin stars. So it is also a kind of a slight challenge for us, but because you don't want to drastically change the whole menu and then people are like, this doesn't feel right. So you have to adapt it slowly and steadily. And I think we are absolutely on the right way because we have the direct contact with the guest and because they give us the direct feedback. So we are really doing this in the most homogeneous way possible.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, are tasting menus talking to each other across the world when it comes to trends? Because you all are operating in this Michelin system. So if, you know, if you're like the 3 stars are tied to the 3 stars and the 2 stars are tied to 2 stars, are you seeing different shifts at other restaurants or is it like you're out there, I know you're doing something great, but we have just our blinders on, we're doing our own thing, we don't care what anyone else is doing?
Yes, I think this is very important. We learned that from our former chef in Holland who had 3 Michelin stars and he never, ever ate at any other restaurants. Now, of course, we eat at other restaurants just to check them out.
Sure,
but it's very important to really keep in tune with Marco and my philosophy by respecting the best products. You know what I'm saying? So we really are trying to do our own thing.
And we totally believe in what we do. And we have also such an amazing team in front of the house, back of the house. So, you know, if we make a new dish, sometimes, you know, we taste it and it's right on the spot. We really go for it. And sometimes it doesn't work. You know, we have to try over and over and over or it never hits the menu. And I think that's also, you know, it's a big plus that we have, that we have such a team effort here, and we have really people that are very knowledgeable, you know, and they're also really already a long time around in fine dining, and especially it makes it, and especially also like me and Max, you know, we are always on the same page.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also important that the whole team in the front of the house, they stayed. Everybody stayed.
Yeah.
Everybody sees the picture. Everybody was, so to say, waiting for us to arrive and reopen. So they're really having our back, and they really feel the new, like, Phoenix out of the ashes vibe, and they really feel the new energy. And you can really tell at their faces that they're happy coming in, and really they're representing us in the utmost best way they can do. It's really amazing to work with them.
Now, I have to ask, I mean, it's long days, it's high pressure. What do you guys do to relax? How do you blow off steam?
So I love to work out every day in the morning. I love to have ice cold showers, and I love to go walk with my dog outside. And I think this is what really connects me, grounds me back. And this is really, I used to work in Munich, and we had a 4-day work week, but it was lunch and dinner. And now we have a 5-day work week without lunch. We have double seatings at night, and we work the same, if not less, here than back in Munich. So this is really, it's really nice. We have the mornings. We can do something. We can try to work out. So it's really nice to also get grounded and back to earth, so to say. It's not even stress. I wouldn't call it stressful. It still is, and will always be a privilege to work here. So I wouldn't. It's of course sometimes it's a hectic atmosphere when there's a lot of things going on, but it's always been. I would never have any negative feeling with going to work. You know what I'm saying? And I think this is the right mindset just to be here.
Marco, what about you?
For me, I have an amazing family. So I have 2 kids. I have a son and a daughter. And honestly, if I have like time left, I bring them to school in the morning. Mm. I play with them. You know, we go on trips. You know, I live in New Jersey. I also like, I work out a little bit in the morning, not every day. You know, kids are very intense sometimes, and they take a lot of your time.
I have 2. Yeah.
And I have to say, I have an amazing wife. She does most of the work for them. That makes me also like, you know, such a privilege that I can do this job then, and I can be fully focused on this. And yeah, to blow off steam, you know, I really love to watch sports. I love soccer. Mm. I love American football. I love the mentality those guys have. They are so, you know, dedicated to what they do. And like, honestly, in this top world of restaurants, it's like a little bit the same mentality. You really need to go for it, and you need to be every day dedicated. You need to love what you do. You really have to have a passion for it. And that's when, you know, what they're going to give the new generation, that is like, you know, dedication, and it's going to take a lot of time, you know, to come there. But don't give up, you know, keep going.
Beautiful. Well, what a great sentiment to end on. If people want to make a reservation, people want to eat with you, what's their best bet of securing a spot?
Honestly, they can just like, you know, we have basically during the week, you know, we have always a spot available, sometimes Saturday nights, Friday nights. You know, it's not that we are fully booked for a whole year. We have spots available. Yeah. We are busy, but like there is spots available for sure.
Yeah. So just plan ahead.
Yeah. Yes.
Congratulations. I hope to swing in the next time I'm in the city. And big shout out to Nicole and Nina for setting this up. We have a song from the archives and then another live performance here on Snacky Tunes on HRN.
Kind of phony atmosphere. It's so hard. straight to the top. When you're on the take, like a crooked car, like a crooked
program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant from French to Pan-Asian to American. And that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit Korin.com.
This episode is supported by HRN Business member, Chemists in the Kitchen by LabX. Chemists in the Kitchen is a YouTube video series by LabX, spotlighting the power of chemistry and how science and food can bring people together. In each episode, real scientists walk you through topics like making your own pickles, the chemistry behind ceviche, and much, much more. It's a love letter to science, cooking, and individuality, with some great tips on how you can apply real scientific principles to your own kitchen. Plus, it's just a lot of fun. Subscribe on YouTube to watch the entire series for free. Chemist in the Kitchen by LabX is a program of the National Academy of Sciences and supports HRN's creative educational reporting and storytelling that drive conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, Greg Bresnitz. We have Leo Linansky and Marcos Porras joining us from Switzerland and Mexico. Welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Hello, hello.
Hi, Greg.
Hi. So we just had a great conversation with James from Gitano, but Leo, you are the music director for Gitano, and Marcos, you are part of the house band trio Habe. It's great to connect with you guys. First and foremost, as we ask everyone during this time, how are you two doing?
I am great. I'm doing fine sitting here in Switzerland. Yeah, summer is coming along. So it's a good time to be here in Europe. How are you doing?
Me, Philadelphia, summer here, not too hot. Good. Marcos, how is Tulum?
Well, we have just like two seasons here in Tulum. We have summer and hail. So now we are in hail. beside that, I have air conditioning on my studio, so it's a good time to produce and to design new projects and stuff. So I'm doing great.
For those of the uninitiated, can you give some characteristics of hell?
Hell,
what
okay.
makes it so?
a million degrees, very humid. And 1,000 mosquitoes by square meter. It's like, yeah, hell. There's no other way to describe it.
Marcos, I want to start with you. You started your musical career when you were 17, and then started playing 19 professionally. What were some of the early instruments that you picked up, and what were some of the sounds that defined your youth?
Okay. I started singing when I was like 9 for school projects and stuff. And then when I was like 15, we wanted to like start, you know, a rock band that was popular at that time. And I was the lead singer, but it turns like I wasn't that good singing. So I started with the bass because I wanted to belong to a band and do music and stuff. I was a rugby player and I injured my leg and I had a lot of free time, you know, like just like high school and rugby for me at that time. And when I injured my leg, I started with music, with bass. That was it. Yeah.
And being from Argentina, what were some of the rock bands that you were into at that time that were influencing your decision to join a group?
Okay, that's a good question. Do you know anything about Argentinian music? It's like we have like a complete different scene in Argentina. That it's a big scene. Maybe Leo knows about Soda Stereo, which is an Argentinian band. Of course. Okay. Soda Stereo is like a pop rock band, a very big band, and we have like plenty of
all over Latin
bands.
America, no? They're famous all over Latin America, no?
Yeah, they are. Yeah, indeed. But Argentinians are very like rock and music fans. The concerts there, I like go to the church, you know? It's like, okay, let's do this. It's like something very spiritual for us. So, and not just for rock bands, but like folkloric bands. And like popular music like Cuarteto, which is a mixture between Tarantella, which is like an Italian rhythm, and Paso Doble, which is like from countryside in Argentina. Cuarteto Burns, and a lot of people, like 5,000 people at least goes to Cuarteto dancing places with live music from Wednesday to Sunday. Always in Cordoba, always. Like it's a very like particular phenomenon there. So I think that we don't choose the music that we are influenced by. I mean, we can be influenced by music in a good way or in a positive way or in a negative way, but we are not choosing the music. We're just like exposed to the music. So all that culture makes me the musician that I am right now.
And Leo, how did you get your start in music? Did you DJ? Did you play in a band? Was it always from the programming side? Where did your passion begin?
It actually started in Berlin a few years ago because I was working in nightlife in some bars and clubs. I was in my very early 20s and started DJing. I mean, the whole thing started probably earlier when I was a teenager. I used to make CDs, like do compilations of music and burn CDs for my friends and stuff like that. But really getting into it in a deeper way was in nightlife there, because in Berlin, I was working in this bar, which was a wild place, a really wild place called King Size. And I started DJing there sometimes. By the same time, I played guitar a lot and started recording music as well. So the whole thing, yeah, I took my way from there and started producing. I was DJing on the side. I just had a feeling for the music that I really liked it. I enjoyed it, making music and playing music. So I don't know. I guess it's just started there at some point and got into my way of music direction came years later. Yeah.
How did you both make your way or find yourself in Tulum?
I went there in 2011 for the first time. I worked in a project in 2012 where I met a lot of people, and somehow I went back to Mexico over and over. I used to live in Europe still by then, but I came back to Mexico all the time. And I made a lot of friends there, worked there frequently, and I had a good time. I really liked it, even though Tulum changed a lot. So, yeah, I guess I started like that, 2011-2012.
And Marcos?
I came here at 2017. Because I got a lot of friends here, and they were like, hey man, you need to go to Tulum because it's so good, you need to go and do music over there and stuff. So I was like finishing some project in Argentina, and I decided to come here, and here I am. Because I really like the place.
Incredible. And when you both arrived there, how would you describe the music scene? You know, what was the sound of Tulum? Is there a sound of Tulum? And who were some of the groups and players?
There definitely is a sound of Tulum. Back in the days, it was very down-tempo, for example. This organic down-tempo music was a huge thing in Tulum. I actually saw a lot of people rising through Tulum into the worldwide scene of music through this kind of music. The whole down-tempo, yeah, oriental, Latin American mix and everything. It has its own special tune for sure, in my opinion.
And Marcos, from the live music scene, which is not always analogous to the DJ scene, what type of music and sounds did you hear there?
If I had to pick one word to describe Tulum and what Tulum means to me in music, it's diversity. Because here I found like a lot of musicians from very different genres. I have been playing with Balkan bands. I have been playing with flamenco bands, rock bands, funk, soul, R&B bands, jazz bands, bossa nova bands. So diverse. It's like a lot of musicians and a lot of different musics and different moods here. I think that's the beauty thing of Tulum, right? Like the diversity.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I have to say as well, when we talk about that, through the years, it went through a change. when with, for example, with the whole down tempo, how it started back in the days, when I went there, not in general, just when I went there in 2011, 2012, that was a big thing coming up. But as Marco says, I feel like nowadays there is a huge diversity. I totally agree on that. For example, Gitano went has a huge disco thing as well. It's really known for disco and house music.
Incredible. Well, why don't we hear a song from Jabe? Marcos, what song are you guys going to play for us first?
The first song, it's the homonymous, it's Jabe.
Amazing. Well, here we go with Jabe on live on Snacky Tunes on Heritage Radio Network. Thank you. Leo, you mentioned that Gitano is known for house and disco. How would you describe the audio signature for the place and how it's evolved into what you know today?
You mean the process, what happened in the last years?
Exactly.
Okay. Well, as I mentioned before, in my opinion, when I came to Tulum, to Tulum for the first time, it was Tulum was very had a strong scene with this down tempo deep house music. Gitano, on the other hand, there is music, such music, of course. We book stuff like that as well as part of my job, but we are very known as well for the whole disco and house elements. The Friday night we have is it's a huge night every week in low season, in high season, and we book a lot of people that play a lot of Afro music from Afro house, disco tunes. It's very eclectic, the whole mix, which makes it for me very interesting to work there as well and book people, because you have a huge there's a diversity in the genres. That's something I really enjoy.
Marcos, Habe formed earlier this year, and you're a trio. How did you come together and put together a group and decide on the sound that you're going to play?
Okay, that's a good question. Well, first I met Fede because, I mean, I'm from Mendoza. I mean, my family is from Mendoza, but I lived in Cordoba from, like, since I was like four. So I'm more Cordobes than Mendocino. And okay, I met Fede in Cordoba and we met again here in Tulum. And I know that Fede likes the same music because he had like a Syrian ancestors. We started the band with Santi, which is another guy, another friend that right now is in Argentina. And like, we know that Santi can't do it like anymore. So we started to make music with Rocco, that it's from Serbia, and he's like a very good producer, very good sound engineer. So we all met and we started to play together, and it works, and it was like amazing. We have a very enjoyable time, and I think that's all about music, right? About connection, chemistry, and when that it's working, everything else is going to work.
Exactly. And how does, do you just play Gitano, or do you travel around and play? Like, how easy is it for bands to play all over the area, or do bands tend to stick to one or two places?
Well, I can say that we're traveling because the band have been formed this year. So, and this year is kind of difficult to travel.
True.
we mainly play not in Gitano. We play in Mese, which is an amazing place from Gitano group. It's Greek, Leo, right? It's a Greek place.
It's Aegean, like the whole area. It's very, it has a Greek.
Okay.
Well, the chef is Greek. He's an amazing cook that makes all the Greek food.
Yeah.
It's Aegean. We call it the Aegean Taverna.
Aegean, yeah.
Yeah.
We started to play there. And now it's Nomade and other places in that area, which is kind of the best area to play and to make music.
Great. Can we hear another song?
Okay.
What's this one?
Let's hear Malaiko.
Malaiko.
one of the coolest things I think about the band is that you guys are attached to Studio Tulum, which is a record label and also studio inside Tulum. Can you tell me a little bit about the history of the label and how it came to be?
Well, I can tell you a little bit because the Studio Tulum, it's an entrepreneurship from Rocos. Studio Tulum, it's a recording studio. It's a very cool recording studio. Rocco, it's an amazing engineer, amazing music producer. And he had produced like a lot of projects here in Tulum, like Samapash, that it's like a flamenco fusion band. And he had produced Camille Gomez-Tuaez, which is a French singer, an amazing French singer that makes like R&B, soul, neo soul, and many other projects that don't came to my mind right now because, as I told you, I'm not the head of Studio Tulum. I'm just attached because of the band. But it's an amazing studio. Rocco have amazing equipment and amazing ideas. That's the cool thing about Rocco. And he really knows the music industry. He really knows how to promote and how to develop. You know. How to develop like projects, how to do it, how to improve and increase your performance as a musician. Rocco, it's really good.
And I know that we're all taking a pause this year on live events. Leo, you were telling me that you cannot throw any parties yet. And for those of people who don't know, in Tulum, certain places have kind of claimed nights of the week. What are you thinking in ways to still bring the Tulum sound and continue to push diversity as we all wait this out together?
Sorry, again, I didn't hear it proper. It was...
What are you planning to do to kind of continue to push out the Tano music to the Tulum community as we all wait this out together?
Yeah. I changed my focus lately while we were closed because of the whole COVID situation. I changed my focus a little bit to the SoundCloud page as well. I asked a lot of people like DJs, artists to record some sets that I can upload on the SoundCloud page, which works really well. And we made posts with that, which was a successful project. It was good to do this because like this, you keep DJs busy basically, or artists in general, and you give them a chance to record something and send it to you, and you can upload it and just spread it through Instagram, for example, and people can still click on the things they were able to listen to at home, or even play on little private parties, which apparently happened a lot all over the planet. So yeah, that was one of the ways that we used to still keep on maintaining the whole music business with Gitano.
And Marcos, as a musician, how are you keeping yourself creatively engaged during this time?
I'm trying to go to the private parties.
Touché. Touché.
We keep producing music. Because like that's like not the thing like that is attached to like work, you know, like to make profit. It's like more, it's a need, you know. We need to produce some music. Actually, we are like making a Tulum album with a lot of artists, different artists that make original music here, and like we are setting up all the marketing strategy and all that stuff. Like we are producing, we are doing music, and that's the interesting thing about this COVID situation, that is how not just the music scene, but the music mindset it needs to turn, you know, because it's very different how it's right now and how it was like 4 or 5 months ago.
I totally agree. I see it around me as well. There's what you're saying reminds me too. I feel like there's a lot of artists out there that get very productive and very creative, and they use the chance that they have a lot of free time, go to the studios and record. And there's other people that really struggle and they lose their creativity. It's really interesting how this whole situation changes the brain sometimes.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree 100%.
Well, we want to make sure we have time for one more song, but where can people find you, follow you, hear your music, hear the DJ sets?
Sorry, mine or Gitanos?
Both.
Okay.
Marcos, say it.
You can find me on Facebook, on Instagram as Javi Music. And we have a SoundCloud spot that it's Javi too.
Yeah, and the whole Gitano thing you can find. Well, there's a lot of links as well in Instagram that we made the post for the artists when we recorded the sets. But also on SoundCloud, for example, you can just enter Gitano sound, like Gitano underline sound. And you find most of the sets there, which were recorded and uploaded.
Amazing. Marcos, what is the name of the last song you guys are going to play for us today?
Okay, this is a very particular name, which like rise in a very particular time. It's Sultan Returns, No One Bend the Knee.
Great name.
Amazing name. Thank you to the whole Gitano crew. We wish you the best of luck in the reopening of all of your spaces. Thank you for tuning into this week's episode of Snacky Tunes. We'll be back next week. See you then.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
Snacky Tunes is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries, like why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.